This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we talk about the economy a lot on this program, and you may have noted that the slowly positive trends in the economy, trends that seem legit, but are also propped up by the Federal Reserve's ultimately unsustainable policy of pledging to buy virtually any amount of housing debt and treasury bill obligations. They're keeping everything afloat. That policy keeps interest rates low and money flowing and business growing. So, can the economy fly by itself without the Fed? Well, it's a question nobody wants to even ask. If the Fed's influence over the economy as a whole is significant enough to be considered a dangerous dependency, consider this: the housing industry. Back before the financial recession, the federal private corporations, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Ginnie Mae, backed about 40% or maybe a bit more of all the mortgages in the U.S. After 2009, though, Fannie and Freddie became total federal entities, and their share of the mortgage market in 2012, guess, did it rise, say, a whopping 100% to back 80% of the market's mortgages? Not even close. Today, Fannie and Freddie, just call them Feddie for the federal government, the feds control 99.3% of all the mortgages and mortgage-backed securities that the U.S. generates each year. That is essentially total federal control of the housing economy. Not unlike the influence, say, the Chinese army has over the hotel industry in Beijing. Government control. So can President Obama get the government out of the mortgage business?
We're actually confident that the private market can step in, do a good job, and the government can be a backstop so that we still have affordability and 30-year mortgages, but it's not the dominant player.
Really? How do you take Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac from total federal ownership and total control of the housing market to something considerably less without doing something dangerous to the economy?
We've got to turn the page on this kind of bubble and bust mentality that helped to create this mess in the first place. We've got to build a housing system that is durable and fair and rewards responsibility for generations to come.
Well, on Wednesday, President Obama answered questions from users of the real estate website Zillow, outlining his vision that will put private lenders back in place of greater financial responsibility for the housing market. And Congress is now considering bills that would phase out Fannie and Freddie over the next 5 years and shrink the government's role in guaranteeing mortgage securities. Joining us now is Massachusetts Representative Michael Capuano from the 7th District, a ranking Democrat on the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Housing and Insurance. Representative, welcome to the program.
How you doing, John?
Boy, the feds control 99.3% of the housing market. How do you pull that back? That's a powerful dependency, it seems to me.
You do it slowly and carefully. No one thinks that that's healthy for the economy in the long run. It was a necessary evil in the short run. But we all want to change that, and we want to get it back to some degree of balance. And you know, most people who are objective about this look in the 70% range that the Fed should be doing, or at least that's what they were doing when no one was complaining about the housing market.
But if the Feds pull back, why would private sector banks get into this business at all without the kinds of federal guarantees or the assurance that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are going to buy their mortgage securities no matter what? It was almost a done deal for the last 4 years.
Well, for the last 4 years, that's right. But before that, and again, I'm talking even before the bubble, when things were steady back in the 90s or the 80s, pick a time frame. But ever since 1933, the federal government has backed up these mortgages one way or the other. They have seldom been called on to deal with it until the recent bubble, but it worked great. It built the middle class. Prior to 1933, there was no federal backstop. Every mortgage was private. The average mortgage was approximately the same rates as we have now, but it required 50% down payment, and it was for a term of 5 years. I represent a pretty middle-class district, and I will tell you that most of my constituents, including me, would never have been able to buy a home if I had to put 50% down and had to pay the term off for over 5 years.
But that means that in the terms that we're talking about now, there's almost more of a need to have a backstop that where the federal government will buy whatever mortgage is.
Well, they don't necessarily have to buy it. They do have to back it up at some point. And that is the basic philosophical difference. I will tell you that in the current debate, I have not found anyone other than a handful of ideological academics who believe that the federal government can get out of the business of backstopping it. There is a difference between buying it and backing it up. But buying it obviously is backing it up. That's the direct way to do it. And that's, we all agree, has happened too much. Backing it up is what they did in the 60s, the 70s, the 50s, the 40s. It's like, if you get in trouble after you've lost your money, we will step in. And that has worked very, very well, as long as you make sure that the fees that you charge are reasonable, as long as you make sure that the requirements you make from the borrowers are reasonable. I mean, you know, but these no-doc loans that we had for a few years, these subprime loans we had for a few years, giving a mortgage to anyone who just walked in the door, those are unacceptable behaviors, and that's what led us to the problem.
Is it possible to do this and keep the housing market out of the very liquid derivatives market? If you try to get the derivatives market out, you're going to really dry up all the cash.
It's hard to say. That's not my goal. I mean, I think the derivatives market has a role to play, and again, it played it well for a long time. But there are different kinds of derivatives. I mean, there are relatively stable, thoughtful derivatives, but then there's incredibly risky derivatives that I do think that we should stay out of, and that's what we're trying to find the balance for now.
One of the ironies here is that this has actually been a darn good business for the federal government. The federal government's been making money hands over fist from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
That's exactly right, and you know, that's all well and good, but that's not the goal here. I mean, because first of all, who are they making money off of? They're making money off of new homeowners, usually middle class people. That's not the goal. Number one. Number two is that we don't think it's a sustainable model. Many of us don't think that. We do think the private enterprise has a role to play. We think that that it should have a significant role to play. But in the final analysis, honestly, the bill that was just passed out of our committee, which gets the federal government out of any aspect of this in a matter of 5 years. Has no support whatsoever except for a few right-wing extreme academic ideologues. Everyone in the business, from home buyers to home sellers to home builders to realtors to banks to anyone who has an objective viewpoint on this, who is part of making this economy go, all believes that this particular bill is too extreme and will destroy the middle-class home market.
So it's going to be hard to take anything but baby steps here.
I think it is, and I actually think that this is too important to do anything other than that. I think baby steps, but thoughtful, consistent baby steps, I think is not a bad way to go in this case. Big, huge steps runs the risk of letting your ideology get ahead of the economy, and I think that's insane. Whether people like it or not, the housing market is a big chunk of our entire economy, never mind what it means to individual homeowners. And for me, I think that that demands a conservative and thoughtful and slow approach towards the changes that we make.
Representative Michael Capuano of the 7th District in Massachusetts, Democrat from Massachusetts on the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Housing and Insurance. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
So can the brokers out there imagine a moment where Fannie and Freddie have just gone away? What would this actually mean for would-be home buyers out there? I'm joined by Brett Berry, an associate broker with HomeSmart in Phoenix, Arizona. Brett, welcome.
Hello. Thank you, John.
So does this terrify you? Does this help the market at all? Is there suddenly going to be private banks coming down on homeowners? The liquidity is just going to go away here?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's terrifying, but I would say that it is highly unlikely, in my opinion, that Fannie and Freddie are going to be exiting the market in the way that the gentleman just described. I also listened to President Obama's speech here in Phoenix a few days ago. I think similar to the immigration debate, I think there's a bit of fantasy here. Right now, the banks have a very nice situation. They get to originate the loans. They get to be paid when they originate the loans. They get to service the loans. That means you pay them like a toll booth when you're the consumer every month. And as long as those loans stay good, everything is good. But if the loans go bad, of course, American taxpayers now are, as you said, 99% on the hook if these loans go bad. So I don't see Fannie and Freddie exiting in the way that these gentlemen are describing. If they do, why would the banks have any interest or their lobbyists in letting this happen? They have a beautiful and sweet and perfect situation right now.
Well, let's go back to what the congressman was saying, Michael Capuano was saying. Look, you know, if you go back just 4 years ago, we did it very differently. All we have to say to the banks is new plan. It's called the old plan. You've had a lovely time over the last 4 years. Now we're going to go back to the way you used to do it. And they'll have to because they want to stay in the mortgage business.
Well, they I don't think they have to. I mean, the best analogy is when you've got a 2 or 3 year old that's still got the binky in the mouth, it's very hard to take that binky out of the baby's mouth, you know, if you remember back that far.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that the banks right now have enjoyed the comfort and the perfectness of the situation. I do not see them willingly doing that. Let's also think about this. The Fed and the Treasury have an extremely powerful lever right now on the economy, which they did not have before. Do they really want to willingly give that up? They don't have that many levers, as we know, and I'm not an economics person. I'm just a lowly realtor for the last 20 years. But that's a very strong lever on housing.
Well, let's talk a little bit. If they were to go ahead with this and there would be some sort of uncertainty, would different areas of the country be affected? Would a certain private sector credit lines be more available for the Northeast, the Southwest? Would it be a problem in Las Vegas, which, of course, had such a serious housing recession? What do you make?
Okay. Well, here in Phoenix, for example, I mean, if this were to play out, if banks were to come back into the market, and I believe they're talking about having them have about a 10% skin in the game. That means if the loans go bad, they'd be liable for 10%. By the way, that doesn't sound too painful to me.
No.
But I would expect interest rates would be far higher than today. Maybe they'd be 6 or 7 or 8% if banks were to get involved. And to be honest with you, maybe that's not such a bad thing. And maybe down payments need to go up too. Maybe not as much as the representative mentioned, 50%. Maybe they need to go up to 10% or 15%. And maybe it would slow things down a bit and also maybe temper some of these overheated markets. Real quick, John, I just want to say our market in Phoenix is up over 25% year over year. Now, from my definition, that seems like it's getting a little heated again, and it makes me nervous, frankly.
All right. So calm down the bubble with some slightly higher interest rates and transactions that actually are more viable than under the umbrella of Fannie and Freddie. Brett Barry, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Brett Barry is associate broker with HomeSmart in Phoenix, Arizona. Stay in your career, leave your career, go raise your family, stay home. How do you make that decision?
This is Ian from Maui. We had a decision to make. She either drops out or I drop out of work. And long decision short, I decided that I would rather take off and let her build her clientele once she graduated than to sit back and watch her founder after working so hard at her dreams. So I spent the next 2 years raising our beautiful baby and turned out to be one of the best jobs I had.
And you live in Maui there, Ian. Thanks so much for sharing. Maui helps anything. The difficulty of a decision to leave your career and raise a family, it's an equal challenge for men and women, but women have some interesting narratives that we're going to explore coming up next. Stay with us. This is The Takeaway. When a few highly educated women executives collectively decided to opt out of the culture of corporate HQ about 20 years ago and announced that they were choosing to leave the workforce to raise their children, the New York Times heralded this as a great moment in the story of the empowerment of women. At the time, journalist Lisa Belkin called it the opt-out revolution. It was their dreams that became the revolution. But 20 years later, the reality of what they experienced, including a recession, is a sobering tale of discovering that outside the comforting cocoon of privilege, there is still a lot of uncertainty. In an upcoming magazine article for our partner, The New York Times, Lisa Belkin and writer Judith Warner decided to return to those women who had previously been chronicled for their triumphant escape from the corporate world to see where they are now and whether they would consider their decision the right one. New York Times contributing writer Judith Warner is the author of The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In, and Lisa Belkin is currently the senior columnist on life, work, and family for The Huffington Post. And as Lisa explains, profiling this particular group of upper-class women may reveal some lessons for the rest of us.
It was an interesting cohort to look at in the first place because they're not the first group of women to choose between their life and work, to have to make these sort of compromises. But they are the first group of women who never thought they'd have to make those choices. And in a way, the story was as much their surprise that they had to choose as the choice that they made. They were raised to believe they could do it all, and they were the first generation qualified enough to do it all. So to watch the ramifications of those decisions, it's telling, it's important.
So part of the story here, Judith, is the tension of having to decide to opt out and the consequences of that, and then a subsequent tension of deciding, you know, I need to get back into this game as well. Judith?
That's right. But I also think that what Lisa said is really the essence of the story and really gets to the uniqueness of this generation as well, in that these were women, and particularly this cohort of women, who were able earlier in their lives to succeed at a very high level at everything they put their minds to. And they discovered their limits in this period of transition out and then back in.
One of the characters, Sheila O'Donnell, in this story was also profiled on 60 Minutes and, you know, was a part of your original reporting, Lisa. I'm wondering how those original assumptions maybe came back to haunt her as she was forced to revisit some of the things that she said and some of the expectations that she had looking back on her own life.
Yes, she left work because she thought it would save her marriage. She and her husband were just butting heads constantly over these unbelievably long weeks that they were both putting in. And so she came home, and as Judy tells the story, she discovered that, you know, they were constantly fighting about other things now, and she felt powerless in this marriage. A lot of her power had come from her earnings. And so she's now divorced. She's back in the workplace. You know, the moral of the story in part is she's back in the workplace in a job that does not pay nearly as much as her old one, but also doesn't require nearly as much of her as her old one. And she, you know, she feels like she made the right choice, but there was a price to be paid. And I really think the lesson is that if you took any group of women of that age over that period of time, they're going to have all the problems that this group of women had, whether or not they kept working or opted out. You know, life got in the way.
Judith, one of the interesting scenes in this story is how one of the women was advised that even though having a job might change the economic calculation in a divorce settlement, that in fact it was so much more psychologically important for her to actually have a job, regardless of what the economic consequences are, and that that was a huge insight for her going forward.
Yes, that she needed to think of this, her lawyer said to her, not as a decision that would just affect her in the months or even the years to come, but as one that would affect her in the decades to come. And that as she moved forward in her settlement also, the less power her husband had over her, the better equipped she would be to sort of stand her ground and get what she needed. And I think that in that case, in that particular marriage, what you saw was that power dynamics that were in place beforehand sort of got worse in the particular situation of Sheila's having taken herself out of the workforce, having lost that sense of identity and that ability to earn her own income, which was particularly important for her.
Lisa, as someone who hears from women at all sort of economic levels, middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class, do you think there's a wisdom in the ways in which lower and working class couples and families and women particularly make these kinds of choices that would help some of these very, very successful women from the executive cohort that Judith looked at?
Oh, let's not romanticize anyone's choices here. They're all hard, and they're all limited. Every social economic strata wishes they didn't have those limits. I think that these are particular choices of a very elite group. But I think that's not insignificant. These are the women who should be running the world, who, when we look around and say, why aren't there women in more positions of power? Here's our answer, because these women decided not to be there. And the fact that they're not in positions of power means that they're not there to change the workplace for other women of all levels coming up behind them. So this is only applicable to a small group, but it's still important to all of us.
Judith Warner, the recession that began in 2008 had a huge impact on the male executive class who were compelled to opt out for various reasons economically, but it probably had consequences for the families, certainly. In terms of the women's lessons for opting out and opting in, what do you think men are going to learn over the next 10 years that's relevant to what you've already reported on?
I think men have always known that they don't really have these choices. I mean, the concept of there being a choice has been something that women have claimed that has been socially permissible for them, and that really hasn't been for men.
Judith Warner is a New York Times contributing writer, author of the Times article, The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In. She's author of the book Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. And the reporting in The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In came in part from work that was originally done by Lisa Belkin, Huffington Post senior columnist on life, work, and family. Lisa and Judith, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
This is Erica from Livingston, New Jersey. When I announced I was pregnant, my mentor said to me, "Welcome to the mommy track." I spent the past 15 years learning what that meant. Being a mom to my kids is the best thing I have or will ever do. But I'm constantly fighting that sinking feeling that I've failed because I didn't live up to my generation's unfounded expectation that we really could have it all.
We want to hear about your experience. How does having children alter your work life? Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE and follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Later this hour, we will hear how the PTSD of a returning soldier became a secondary trauma for his entire family. One of the public health effects of war is collective trauma, the obvious signs from natural disasters and the subtle signs that a whole community is involved in the suffering of its members. Mary DeYoung is a professor of sociology at Grand Valley State University who specializes in the collective experience of post-traumatic stress disorder. She says as remote as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq seem, collective trauma is actually a very familiar story in America.
Communities and collectivities, societies, groups of people end up having to deal with PTSD in a different kind of way or deal with trauma in a different kind of way. There is usually a coming together of people immediately after a traumatic event if it's a fairly discrete event. But eventually, the politics and the divisions that characterize communities and collectivities begin to play a little bit, and the cohesion begins to break down. So we don't see communities coping in the same kinds of ways as individuals cope.
In terms of communities that you've studied, which ones stand out to you as examples of how humans either rise to the occasion or can be defeated or certainly experience great pain from a collective trauma?
Well, we've certainly seen some if we look at our own country, and particularly recent events, the shootings, for example, of the young children in Connecticut over the holidays. You saw an incredible coalescence of the community, not just the local community, but throughout the entire nation. So people did come together, and very often communities will say things like, or representatives of communities will say, our community will never be the same. But in fact, there always is a kind of pressure to return to the familiar, to live out those patterns that people are extremely familiar with. And that usually happens in most communities. That's not a breakdown of caring or empathy or support in any way. It's just how communities operate.
In thinking about the individual stories of PTSD from Iraq and Afghanistan and the families who are dealing with this, I'm wondering if the way in which we deal with the military in the United States cuts them off from a sense of community healing. I'm thinking of the Newtown example that, maybe makes it harder for them to recover, makes it more likely that they're going to feel isolated. And how should we interpret their stories of PTSD as a way of figuring out how to embrace what it is they're going through and remember that it's happening to all of us.
Yes. I think that is a risk, that there is isolation, because we don't really understand in a lot of ways what our men and women are experiencing in Afghanistan, as an example. And we often don't want to hear it either. We would like to see them as warriors and not as victims, particularly. And that, I think, is very isolating. And if the military as an institution in any way plays into that by not acknowledging or not dealing adequately with our soldiers who are experiencing PTSD, then we really have set a very lonely course for them.
Mary DeYoung is professor of sociology at Grand Valley State University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She specializes in the collective experience of post-traumatic stress disorder. Professor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
More on our look at PTSD later this hour.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
No!
I'll be Spartacus. It's a busy movie Friday. And as always, Rafer Guzman, movie critic for Newsday, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, the two hosts of the Movie Date podcast are here with us. Hey, Rafer. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, John.
Hi, John.
So first question is, are cars as charming as little planes?
I'm telling you to forget all this race and malarkey. You just ain't built for it. You're a crop duster.
You don't think I know that? You don't think I know that? I'm the one who's been flying back and forth across the same fields day after day, month after month, for years. I've flown thousands of miles, and I've never been anywhere.
Disney Toon Studios has this offering here, animated planes in a story that, you know, is reminiscent of Cars and all the other animated things they've done. Disney Toon Studios, that's not Pixar, Rafer?
That is not Pixar. This is actually the home video wing of Disney. And this film was originally supposed to be a straight-to-video sequel, kind of like Beauty and the Beast 3 or Little Mermaid 4 or that kind of thing. But they upgraded it to a theatrical release, and I think they should not have. It's really just a dreary, dreary imitation of Cars.
Which is worse, watching this movie or actually flying commercially?
This movie was one of the worst movies I've seen this year, and it's too bad because, you know, they could have done something really great with this, but instead it's just the same thing we've seen a million times before, not just in Cars and not just in Turbo, but in every other movie where you have a little engine that could, and I just wish that it wouldn't have.
Just to go back to Thomas the Train and be satisfied with that. Well, there's a lot of anticipation for the Percy Jackson, the latest Percy Jackson franchise, Sea of Monsters. Listen.
Excuse me, we're trying to get to Florida.
Our kind of fare. Pricey.
Whoa! Maybe we should have flown commercial.
Ah! Look out!
Calm down. If we didn't know what we were doing,
we wouldn't be licensed.
This sounds much wackier than the actual books themselves. Does it come together?
It does. I think Percy Jackson, as a franchise, has had a difficult time getting out from under the shadow of Harry Potter. You know, it's a magical boarding school. Instead of wizards, it's demigods. But I think the more that Harry Potter sort of fades from memory, the more this film's going to be able to establish its own personality. And I think it does pretty well. It's entertaining, some really good special effects. I feel like the cast is still a little low on charisma, but they could still find their footing in future films.
Is it a good story?
Yeah, well, it involves the Golden Fleece. I do like Jake Abel, the actor who plays the villain in this film. He was in The Host. He's really good. He's like a young Kevin Bacon. He gives the movie a bit of an edge, but it's pretty much just a kind of an old-fashioned quest. Mostly what you're there for is the special effects, the feel of adventure, and it delivers on that.
I feel a B-minus there. Now, the edgy offering for the weekend is We're the Millers. You've got your Jennifer Aniston and Jason Sudeikis. And Sudeikis is a drug dealer, right?
Pot dealer.
And Aniston is a stripper.
Yes.
They're pretending to be together. This has all the family dysfunction that I know is just the kind of thing you love, Kristen. Let's listen.
Oh, you have a baby! Oh, I love babies! Oh, look at that gorgeous little bundle of toys!
What's that beautiful little baby's name?
This is our little...
LeBron!
And...
That's not really a baby. It's a bag of marijuana. These two are on a road trip. They've decided to become drug traffickers to recoup some losses. They're going to make a lot of money posing as just your typical family on a road trip. And, you know, it's a really stupid premise, and it's really schlocky, and I loved every minute of it.
Loved it.
I just thought it was adorable and sweet, and I laughed.
Rafer.
Too much gross sexual humor for me that did not belong anywhere in the movie. Otherwise, I thought it was actually kind of a clever premise.
Finally, should we see Elysium, Matt Damon's attempt at dystopia?
It's okay. You don't have to. You really don't have to.
Ham-fisted political allegory, long and not that fun. A real disappointment from the guy who did District 9.
All right. Rafer Guzman, Kristen Meinzer, Movie Date Podcast, and our movie offerings for this very busy weekend. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John.
And now a huge milestone in medical research, an overdue recognition of one of the most unusual consequences of medical research at the cellular level, and a quiet but hugely important thank you to a family with its genetic imprint on tens of thousands of medical studies involving standardized tissue cells. This week, the National Institutes of Health decided to formally acknowledge the medical contribution of the tissue cells of Henrietta Lacks, the HeLa cells, and her descendants. At age 31 in 1951, doctors harvested her cells, and researchers have been using them ever since in thousands of studies. Rebecca Skloot told part of this story in her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Rebecca, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is really an additional chapter, an epilogue to the story that you told. Is this an acknowledgement, a thank you, or a recognition that maybe there's some compensation due here?
Well, I think it's a lot of different things. It's definitely a recognition of, you know, her family's contribution to science. And I think it's a recognition of the fact that we still don't have very clear legislation or guidelines when it comes to tissue research, especially when it involves genes. You know, it's still not required to get consent for all tissue research or genetic research. So I think this is the first step, you know, toward that happening, and the NIH saying, okay, let's stop using this family in research in some way or another without their involvement, because that's not okay.
Isn't there a contradiction, though, between the sort of corporate incentives to try to patent individual genes based on intellectual property issues associated with finding and identifying them, and a family wanting to own or have some sort of level of ownership of its own genetic material if it ends up being used in research?
Well, yes. I mean, there would be. You know, what's interesting about this entire process is, you know, when these meetings started in March, so just to back up a little bit, some scientists sequenced the HeLa genome and published it online without the family's consent in March, which led to the family saying, we don't want that to have happened, and they took it down. And so that led to some of these discussions. And I was in the room for the whole time. And the first part of the discussions, definitely there were questions about patenting. There were questions about commercialization. It wasn't the main focus. But you know, there was a Supreme Court case that was being heard right at the same time and decided on about whether you could patent genes, whether scientists could. So in the beginning, yes, that was a big question mark. And then toward the middle of these discussions, the Supreme Court ruled no, you know, corporations and companies and scientists can't patent genes, which changed the discussion. So it was really an amazing moment of science kind of working in real time with policy changes and legal changes.
And, you know, it's normally that science renders politics moot. It's not so often the case that politics renders certain aspects of a scientific discussion moot. In your case, the book that you wrote and the story that you told and the investigation that you did in many ways is driving this on some level. Are you advising the Henrietta Lacks family?
Yeah, I've been involved from the beginning. You know, I was the one who first told them that the genome had been published online in the first place, so that they were able to say they didn't want that to have happened. And then, yeah, I've been in some ways working on this story for 14 years. And my role with the Lacks family has always been one of sort of almost translator. So I've been observing their story and documenting it and also explaining science to them along the way. And so that's sort of what I continued to do here. And my role in these meetings was that I sort of gathered everyone in the room. I said, okay, you know, Frances Collins and Nancy and Kathy Hudson at the NIH, who are real experts in this. I brought in a bioethicist who I knew the family had gotten to know and trust. And so I sort of gathered all the experts in the room and then said, okay, you know, you guys discuss. And I just basically listened and then answered questions if people had them. But my role was mostly just to document what was going on.
What's your dream scenario? You are an author.
Well, my dream, I mean, in some ways, you know, I set out to write this book, the book, because there was a huge discussion that I thought needed to happen. You know, there was this incredibly important story in history that has real implications today for the Lacks family, as well as sort of all of society. And, you know, my goal wasn't to tell people what policy decisions needed to be made, who should be doing what, but to say, here are all the sides of the story, you know, the important science that comes from this and why we want all want this kind of research to happen, but also the human side of this and what can happen when it happens with when this moves forward without consent. And so I sort of wanted to put all of that out there and say, discuss.
Well, you've certainly succeeded at that. Let me ask you one final question. Is the value of the HeLa cells now in that they are baseline cells, that they represent a baseline of research and will therefore compare study to study over tens of thousands of studies? Or is there something about their survivability that makes them unique and valuable?
Both. They're, you know, part of it is that they're the first ones that ever grew, so they're the most widely studied. We know the most about them. They're also incredibly hardy, so they still grow unlike any other cells. And yeah, they do provide this sort of baseline place to start for research.
Well, Rebecca Skloot, congratulations, I think, are in order. It's certainly important for you to carry this story forward and is carried forward with this decision by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Rebecca Skloot is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Late at this hour, a family's collective torment from the effects of PTSD. We want to take a moment and note how takeaway stations around the country have been profiling American servicemen and women struggling with PTSD for years. Iraq war veteran Phil Lippin suffered a traumatic brain injury and shared his story of isolation with our partners at WGBH Radio.
I think the biggest thing was not having anybody next to me like I did when I was in the military, especially in Iraq. No battle buddies, and I didn't know anybody here. It was really hard to adjust to the routine in a university as opposed to the routine that I was used to. So different points of views, and I had been under this military mindset for so long, and it kind of took me a while to come around and be a civilian again.
From KUT Radio in Austin, veteran Andrew O'Brien shared a story of how impossible it is to keep his war's anger inside.
So my first sergeant pulled me out in front of my formation and called me out in front of everybody, you know, and told everybody about my mental issues, and that stuff's supposed to be private, you know. So I just felt embarrassed by that. So after that, I just stopped talking about it, and I just pushed it down. And then a couple months later, in November of 2010, I finally just decided I was done. And I was tired of pushing it down, and I was tired of not being able to talk about it and open up about it and feeling ashamed for feeling the way I did. And so I go into my kitchen and find four bottles of pills, chug them down, and then next thing I know, I wake up and I'm in the hospital the next morning.
If you have family or loved ones suffering from PTSD, we want to hear their stories. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's a story taking place all around the United States. Tell us how the rest of us civilians here in America can help, or just listen. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. There's much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
We return now to our look at PTSD and a family who was battling something they didn't understand until long after the war was over. When Corporal Jeffrey Lucy, a Marine reservist, went over to Iraq in 2003, his parents couldn't have been more worried. But when he came home later that year, they couldn't have been more relieved.
We saw a very proud, a very relieved, a little bit thinner, tanned young man with a huge smile on his face. He was physically unscathed. He wasn't wounded.
Unscathed on the outside, but Jeffrey's father, Kevin, soon discovered that there were other wounds and fears on the inside. A fear of spiders Jeffrey had always had came back from Iraq bigger and darker.
He started having hallucinations, audio, tactile, visual. For example, as a little boy, he was terrified of spiders. And over in Iraq, they have these rather large spiders called camel spiders. At nighttime, because he couldn't sleep, he would be searching for camel spiders that he said he could hear crawling in his room. And he had a flashlight that was hidden under his bed.
Soon after his return, Kevin Lucy understood that his son was far from unscathed. And the wounds he was seeing, that he still doesn't fully understand today, were beginning to terrify himself and the rest of his family.
His body returned, but that wasn't our son. That was somebody that was so wounded. But there was a delay of time in us being able to see those wounds. His defense mechanisms just started falling apart. And then all of a sudden, we were dealing with somebody that we had never seen before.
When did you become certain that, you know, he had something on the order of PTSD, something that he needed to be diagnosed with or therapy for?
It was the day before the first anniversary of the war. And he and his girlfriend were supposed to go to Vermont with a couple of other couples. And instead, he became depressed. He and her had a tremendous argument. And so, therefore, he came back and he just stayed in our home, just staring at the fire in the fireplace. And that was when, on that day, a lot of the symptomology just exploded. And we begged him to try to go to a VA to get some help, but he was so concerned about stigma. He did not want his unit to think that he was weak.
And all of that, including the combat experiences, the stress of being a Humvee driver, sort of all together became the center of his world in those moments of depression.
It did. So he responded a lot of times by going out on our deck where all you can see is green, bushes, trees, what have you. And it was there that there were times that he would just break down silently and start crying, and tears would be flowing. He just suffered. He just suffered much more than we even knew. He did share with his sister in May that he had picked out a tree and a rope. And so she shared that with us, and that's when we really tried to give him deadlines to try to go and get help.
During your son's life, prior to entering the military, did you ever have any suspicion that he was suicidal, prone to depression, emotionally unstable in any way?
Oh, no. No. Jeff was a very fun-loving, a very social boy. When he was growing up, he was a clown. He was a rascal. He was just – he enjoyed life. He really did. He was very popular in high school. He played sports.
If you had the opportunity to trade the hurt that your son suffered in Iraq mentally for the bullet you were so relieved he didn't receive, would you trade it now?
That's a hard question. We hated to see him suffer, and I thought that he had turned the corner. The night before he died, he came to me, and here we have this 5'11 Marine, and he asked me if he could sit in my lap, and if we could rock like we did when he was a little boy. And I really thought that possibly he was coming back to us. But then within 18 hours, he was in my lap for the final time when I was taking the noose from around his neck. So would I ask that he have a quicker death? Well, to be true to you, John, I would have asked that he just was able to have a good life. It was horrible to see him suffer like the way he did. I remember over at the funeral cursing God. Why did he give him to us if he was going to let him suffer that way?
So if instead of a few hours before he died, if a few hours after he arrived back from his deployment, he had sat in your lap and told you the horrible things he had experienced, got them off his chest immediately, things that, of course, he couldn't tell you. But if he had, what would you have said to him?
I think I would have hugged him. And I would have said, let's walk together and let's find help, not only for you, but for all of us. So now our family has become his voice. And we try to do so without any anger. We've had a number of military families reach out to us from throughout the nation. And what has happened is they tell us, we don't want to become like you. We don't want to become grieving parents. And so we try to tell them about the mistakes that we made. And we tell them, you're going to get overwhelmed. You're going to get tired. You're going to feel like you can't do anything right. But don't give up. Don't give up. And never believe for a minute that they won't do it. That was one of my gravest sins. I believed blindly that Jeff would never commit suicide. Not my son. But, you know, there are so many. There are so many veterans. They average, they say, 22 suicides every single day in this country. And that's according to a VA report. Something's wrong. Our son, that was over 9 years ago, was 9 years and a month ago. And we're still seeing the numbers climb. There are so many Jeffreys out there.
Kevin, so sorry for your loss, and I really admire what your family has done to try to help educate the rest of us, and the best of luck to you.
Thank you, John.
It was Kevin Lucey, father to Corporal Jeffrey Lucey, a United States Marine Corps reservist and Iraq War veteran who took his own life after suffering from PTSD. His very personal testimony provides an end to our extended discussion on the impact of PTSD. Our hearts go out to Jeffrey and all the families we spoke to. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.